This may be like a Cook County forest or something.
I think it is a forest preserve.
Well, we're right next to Highway 53, and we're headed towards the Sanitarian Ship Canal and the old Illinois and Michigan Canal.
Okay, and the day is kind of overcast, it's rainy, it's cold. What's the month?
We're in the merry month of May.
Okay, and so we're headed towards this demarcation line. You see it on the map, the ship canal, this old barge canal, the I&M canal, and here's a power line, high voltage power line. What are we going to do here?
We're here on the trail of how Chicago became one of the centers of global capitalism. And it's a trail because it's a path, and it's a path because people become dependent on that path in a way. They become patho-dependent.
Pathological.
Pathological is clearly the state that we're in, you know, even though it's called Illinois. And that's really kind of what we're studying. We're trying to figure it out. Like, we walk this path whether we want to or not. So we decided that we want to open our eyes and walk it and see how it has been built, what has been entailed in all of that building and rebuilding, you know, because now the old canals and, in fact, the old portage route that sort of started it all have been overlaid with railroads and, more recently, superhighways, and now there are new hyper-modern rail facilities out there, plus oil refineries, pipeline systems, and many other things. And all of that coexists with what we see so clearly in the rain, which is that all of this is a marsh.
Or a mishmash.
Yeah, some kind of a mishmash of things and people
I'm wondering, animals. Do you think that the people who laid out these lines, who surveyed for the high voltage lines we're now walking under, or this path that we're following that takes us underneath the interstate, that they had an idea of what direction they were leading others in, or they themselves in?
Yeah, we don't really know that. We know that somebody constituted a thing called the Canal Heritage Corridor. And they tried to link together all the parks that are along this corridor. And you find parks, museums, signs that tell you the story of this area, which they've taken to calling a corridor now. And we even call it a corridor. We call it the Southwest Corridor. And yet they don't really ask where this corridor is leading. That's the difference, I think, between what we see around us. We see a lot of interest in history, but without the philosophical question, but what's all this history for? Or where is this history going to go? Is it a path to somewhere, or are we just patho-dependent?
That's part of the pathological.
Yeah, well, it is. It is. And you know, it is funny, but we don't actually have the answer either. So it's only partially funny. I mean, we do think that somehow there has to be a balance between following the path as it's been laid down and trying to feel out, perceive, dream up, and enact other paths.
So that's part of sort of parting the assumptions that form the curtain that sort of channel our conscious understanding of what it is we are walking through and past. Do you mind saying your name and what this project is about, or under the auspices of what group?
Yeah, my name's Brian Holmes, and the immediate project here is an exhibition called Foreign Trade Zone that's also a set of learning walks and a mapping process that fits into a website called Southwest Corridor, Northwest Passage. And all of that grows out of a place finding and a direction finding effort called the Compass Group, which has been imagining and exploring the Midwest Radical Cultural Corridor for 5 or 6 years now.
So actually, it's a form of education, educational exploration.
Yeah, it's a radical education project with ties to activism and to art.
And it has a long history, at least to my understanding, of where this idea of asking questions instead of just accepting the answers offered to you. And I just note that something has overflowed its banks and is water is running into the fields, or into the fields. This may be the canal. Which canal is this?
We're now crossing the Des Plaines River. We're actually on a cement bridge that's probably been put here with the funds of the good taxpayers of Illinois to create their heritage and our heritage, or what
allows the presumed inspection of their heritage.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the Des Plaines River. It has overflowed its bounds. It's a river that flows along the lip of the old glacial moraine that used to be the outer edge of the what is now Lake Michigan back 100 million years ago, or X amount of time that I don't know the number exact. And it flows towards the south, and then it takes a curve and turns sort of west. So we're at the point where it's already turned west, and it's heading out west to join the Illinois River and ultimately the Mississippi. These are things that it's beautiful to know about because it touches you with the land. I mean, by knowing about it, by seeing it, by breathing it, by walking on it, and if you dare, by swimming in it, you could be much more aware of where you are. And that's definitely the sense of our project, not only to know where we are but who we are, because what flows through us is actually ultimately the water of Lake Michigan, which we drink, and what flows out of us are different effluents actually go into the canal right over here called the Sanitarian Ship Canal, which at many points is one and the same with the Des Plaines River that it flows right next to at many points. And at some points, the very barges that come laden with grain or coal or chemicals are floating on the Des Plaines River, which they're treating as a canal, even as we treat it as a kind of sewage dump. So all these things you don't have to know about if you just take I-55, and in fact, you can't even see them because freeway doesn't allow you to see, hear, touch, or even imagine anything.
And hopefully you've got your eyes on the road.
Yeah, exactly. So we try to take our eyes off the road and come here to what's really an incredible barge port where the Noramco Corporation has its facility set up, and where, you know, lots of steel and chemicals are kind of treated around here. We've got barge noises all around us in addition to the freeway noise. We're looking at a barge being pushed by what's called a tugboat, but really is a kind of a push boat.
It's a pusher.
Yeah, it's a pusher, and there's a bunch of other pushers docked here.
Capital is pushy,
and it pushes barges around. So
barges and people and cities and streets.
Yeah. So we've come to a turning point at which, because there are many people around who speak, I think I'm going to abandon my speaking role and allow others to do it.
But One last point. I first participated in the initial walk on this project, where we crossed some borders up by the Chicago River and the I&M Canal Heritage Park. Is it? Can you say just a few sentences about that?
Well, in a way, they say it all began at the Illinois and Michigan Canal Origins Park on Ashland, right near the Chicago Sun-Times building. The fantastic thing is where it all began, you can't see anything about the I&M Canal, which has disappeared from sight, from sound, from touch, from taste, and it's all buried under the next layer of railroad lines and then another layer of the Chicago Sun-Times. And that's kind of the way everything is. We forgot where we came from, how all of this was built. I'm not talking about mythical origins. I'm talking about how Chicago was built just 2 centuries ago and all the things that make it tick and turn over and gesticulate today. And I think those things, including every technical detail are something like our social unconscious. And so indeed we do want to wake up and at least experience the end of our species rather than simply accelerating it forever. And that is the philosophical part of our project. And so we found it amazing that at the Canal Origins Park there's really no sign or no way to even understand where you are. And we did want to retrace that walk, lead it to the Cook County Jail and to the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization and what they're trying to do with the land that people live on in that part of Chicago, and just go onward from there.
And as we heard a little bit earlier at another talk given by Sarah Lewison about bioregionalism and the reconnection between nature and the land and the ecology on which is integrated between the land, the water, and the human beings and other life.
Well, for that reason, let's just... Hey, Sarah Lewison, your name has been mentioned, and I'm trying to get out of this radio interview. So, could you talk about...
We just mentioned bioregionalism. Is there any around us? Can you point some out?
It's everywhere. So, we're right on top of the Des Plaines River, which is where all of the water surrounding here from the highest points around, we can see the bluff called Roberts Bluff Road. You can see High Point on the other side to the west, another bluff. All of the water drains into this water source, which continues moving west and then south as it eventually merges with the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, and then finally the Illinois River, and then finally the Mississippi River. The watershed is the space that's all the high points that surround these river basins, these low places. Another thing that drains into this is the highway overhead that you can hear. And you can see going down the pillars that support this massive six-lane freeway, drain pipes that are also sending water down into the Des Plaines River from the asphalt road top.
And so they're sending industrial products in the form of atomized latex from the tires and oil and other things.
Scattering, and things like that. And I suppose you could also see, I mean, there's a bunch of litter in the river because, of course, when the water comes, it picks up everything. So there were paper cups and plastic cups and styrofoam and a sign from Pods. And one of the ways that people think about the, one of the first ways that people learn to think about environment or ecology is to start to notice this human garbage that sort of stands out in places like rivers.
Do you think that's the norm for people who come from consumer societies, but not the norm for people who live closer to nature? They would think about the beauty, the animals, the natural aspects of it before they conceptualize it as just a corridor for garbage?
No, I don't think that either one, actually. I think the third position is that we think about what surrounds us, and we thoughtlessly dispose of things. Humans, I mean, by we right now, and we always have. But I think that, I mean, I've lived in a place where people were surrounded by a really undeveloped environment, and where there were beautiful little creeks and rivers and a really unspoiled landscape, you would call it, but people just threw their trash out. So it's really something that needs to be culturally unconditioned. If the trash is the important part, if it's decided, but and that should be decided by studying what does the trash do to those spaces. Does it harm them or does it make them happy? I'm being really objective here because it's just objects. So
it may be that within the nature of human existence, people just had a need. When they no longer needed the object which filled their needs, they disposed of it where it was most convenient. One time, the things they disposed of biologically deteriorated or were reincorporated into the surrounding natural world.
That's exactly what I was about to say. So the place where I lived people used manufactured objects that they used in their daily life out of bamboo, things like that, out of materials that if they threw those materials back out into the field, out into the forest, they decomposed and they provided nutrients for whatever else was there. So now if I have a plastic cup or a 55-gallon drum of PCBs, I do the same thing. But it isn't so nice on the ground where it falls anymore. Because there's no system that can adequately...
Well, here, I see a sign that says emergency spill response. Would you like to address the assumption that is embedded in that statement that you can respond to the kind of emergency one creates by dumping PCBs and these petrochemicals into the natural environment?
Well, you know, spills always happen, and pipelines always break, and pipelines always leak. And so we have a very risky society that kind of, you know, that would be the conclusion I would make, is we live in a society that's really interested in taking very, very big risks at the expense of the what it spills into, the water, even though we still have to drink the water.
Well, this gets to the issue of consensus, whether or not the majority of people are apprised of the risks that they're being involved in, and whether they are approving of them for some perceived benefit.
I mean, this is a really good sign, by the way, another one. Unauthorized entry constitutes a breach of security, and the supposed owner of this property is ADM. Archer Daniel Midland. So, wow.
Corporate felon.
Wait, so the leading question was the...
whether the people are actually if they want to be poisoned.
If they're asked, but they don't know. I mean, I think it can't go back to the people. People are very humans, are very sensitive, super, super sensitive creatures that learn enormous amounts from their environment and accept, as any organism living or growing, you use your environment as part of a way to make yourself what you are and to understand yourself and your society, what, like, larger, your family and then beyond household. And so it's not only that people haven't been asked, but I think that if they were asked, they wouldn't understand, because I think that there's a... The sensitivity of humans also involves a certain amount of trust, that we're kind of loving creatures. We're actually fundamentally cooperative and peaceful. And so if we are told it's okay for us, we would like to believe that. So it's actually treachery. It's actually treason that the water that people are being given is unsafe, that it would be contaminated, because there's such a high level of trust that's kind of created as kind of the compact of this great state, or what's called a civilization, is that it's going to be okay for you.
Who would you identify as the people who are benefiting from the trust, or are they like priests? Are they the masters of capital? Are they the equivalent of the great ancient civilizations in South America, the high priests who used to commit the sacrifice on the top of pyramids? Are they those kind of people, or who?
Well, I think probably all of those. I mean, anyone who's not having to... I think we can put the finger pretty firmly on capital and capitalism and the idea that it's okay to despoil and steal and extract or to dump in the resources that are necessary for all.
So that 1/10 of 1%.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
We could agree.
Are there a few names
we could agree
attach
on that?
Should we just get the annual issue of Forbes, richest 1,000 or 100?
I mean, Monsanto is the one that I've been studying a lot. So they're pretty particularly pernicious, because this is part of this idea of a system of trust that's created. What they tell everybody is we're helping to build life, and we're helping to create life, and helping you make more life, and make everyone healthy and happy in it. And meanwhile, all the technologies are essentially untested. And when they are tested in the field, they fail. They fail to do what they say they'll do, and they fail to protect the very life they say they're trying to propagate. Mm-hmm.